Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Imagine you're an independent digital creator in the late summer of 2008.
Right, a time when the whole industry consensus was incredibly rigid.
Exactly. To be taken seriously at all, you basically had to emulate national public radio.
You know, investing in those expensive condenser microphones, stapling acoustic foam all over your closet walls.
Yeah, you were supposed to be striving for that pristine, dead silent background of a professional broadcaster. But then there is Big Fatty.
The complete opposite of all that.
Completely. This is a man who actively refuses to turn off his roaring, overburdened box fan, who literally strips off all his clothes just because he's feeling a little sweaty, and who simply hits record.
It's wild. But today, we're exploring why that exact brand of unfiltered environmental defiance actually built one of the most fiercely loyal audiences in the early days of digital broadcasting.
Welcome to Ruination, the early years. I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
We're so thrilled to have you with us as we open up the historical source material from the Big Fatty Online, or BFO, archives.
And this is such a fascinating deep dive into the source material today.
It really is. We are taking you back to a highly specific, highly volatile week, really. Late August of 2008, covering broadcasts 147 through 151.
Yeah, this is a stretch of tape where the rigid, totally non-negotiable 20-minute daily format of his audio journal just violently collides with a bunch of chaos.
Right. Out-of-town guests arriving, a major broadcast milestone, and some deeply, deeply localized theme park lore.
The source material from this specific week is just a masterclass in contrasting behaviors, honestly.
Totally.
I mean, we are looking at a creator who is completely unbound by traditional rules of broadcasting, yet simultaneously operates with this meticulous, military-like precision in other areas of his life.
It's a crazy paradox. Well, we're going to examine how he manages his physical environment, his digital audience, and, well, his own personal mythology.
Oh, we really have to look squarely at the absurdity of that mythology.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're talking about recording completely naked just to beat the South Carolina heat.
We're talking about actively avoiding inappropriate touching on a family-friendly Disney ride.
Yes. And perhaps most importantly, we're actually dedicating an entire formal segment later on to holding this host accountable for his stubborn, just unwavering refusal to admit objective reality.
It really exposes the underlying psychology of a brand built entirely on the concept of being ruined.
So let's just jump right into the timeline. It's August 25th and 26th, 2008.
Okay, so Big Fatty has just returned from an event known in the archives as the 15th anniversary Hera.
Right. He is back in his home studio, which he affectionately dubs the Fat Cave, and he is preparing for the arrival of a major network peer.
Brian from Boston.
Yes, Brian from Boston, who holds the incredibly prestigious title of the resident historian.
Which is great, but before Brian even sets foot in South Carolina, Big Fatty has to reckon with the physical reality of his recording environment.
And that gives us our first major artifact of the week, because the audio for broadcast 147 is heavily, I mean, almost aggressively distorted by the sound of blowing air.
It is a literal wind tunnel.
It really is.
If you listen to the raw audio, it sounds as though he just set up his microphone on the tarmac of an active airport.
Yeah, but rather than attempting to fix it or, you know, utilizing software to gate the noise, he leans entirely into the distortion.
He does way more than lean into it. He basically weaponizes it against the listener.
Right. He explicitly addresses the terrible audio quality right out of the gate. He says, and this is a quote, "Don't bother telling me. I know it sounds like Big Fatty's in a wind tunnel, but y'all, it's hot, and Big Fatty's got the fans on."
And then he takes a direct shot at the very creators we were just talking about, the ones trying to sound like NPR.
Exactly. He notes that some creators are nice enough to turn off their fans and their AC when they record.
And then he delivers what is basically the thesis statement for his entire operation. He says, "F it. I am not going to do that. So just turn it off now. You've already downloaded it. That's all."
You've already downloaded it. I mean, wow.
Right.
That line is just so telling about the technological constraints of 2008.
We really have to remember how media consumption worked back then. I mean, there was no seamless streaming.
No, not at all. You had to actively subscribe to an RSS feed on your computer, wait for the MP3 to download over whatever internet connection you had, physically plug your iPod into your desktop with a 30-pin cable.
Oh my gosh, the 30-pin cable.
Right, you had to sync the device and then physically carry that hardware with you.
So by the time you were in your car commuting to work or walking on a treadmill, you were basically a captive audience.
Exactly. He is openly leveraging the sunk cost fallacy.
Completely. You spent the time and the bandwidth acquiring the file, so you are going to sit there and listen to the wind tunnel.
Yeah, but I think it goes deeper than just technological leverage, you know?
Also,
well, this is an act of radical environmental transparency. By prioritizing his own physical comfort, keeping those fans running in a sweltering South Carolina summer over the auditory comfort of his audience, he shatters the illusion of the polished broadcast studio.
That's a really good point, but does that actually work?
What do you mean?
I just look at this and I wonder if intentionally ruining the audio quality is a kind of psychological loyalty test for the audience.
Oh, absolutely. If you're a casual listener, you hear that fan noise and you immediately delete the file.
Right, you're out.
But if you stay, you are tacitly accepting his terms. You aren't listening to a professional. You are sitting in a hot spare bedroom with a friend.
It operates exactly like a loyalty test. It's a highly effective filtering mechanism. I mean, you don't clean up the house or turn off the fans for family. You just tell them to ignore the mess.
Exactly. This lack of polish establishes immediate, completely unearned intimacy.
And speaking of unearned intimacy, this environmental defiance sets the stage perfectly for the arrival of the Pants Off Express.
The Pants Off Express.
Yes, Brian from Boston officially arrives in the Charleston area.
Right, and we get this great build-up where Brian is hanging out at a local spot, Patrick's Pub, having a drink with another key network figure, Larry H. Vader.
They call into the show, and Brian casually mentions that during a recent trip to Nashville, Tennessee, there had been some quote-unquote pants-off activity.
Which is all the leverage Big Fatty needs.
Obviously.
He brings Brian back to the Fat Cave to record a highly anticipated segment called The Gaze.
And this is actually a significant moment in the historical timeline, isn't it?
It is, because it's the very first time Big Fatty has ever had an in-studio guest in the Fat Cave to record this specific segment.
And how do they commemorate this historic in-person recording?
Oh, by recording completely 100% naked.
Naked.
Two men sitting side by side in a sweltering room with the fans roaring, speaking into a microphone with zero clothing on.
The Pants Off Cast.
The Pants Off Cast. And when asked if it's uncomfortable to be sitting there without pants during an interview, Brian offers this incredibly practical, nonchalant justification.
What does he say?
He simply admits that he was a little fitzy.
A little schvitzy.
I know, it's such a mundane reason for such an extreme broadcast choice.
But you know, when you look at how modern audiences consume media today, this actually feels remarkably prescient.
Wait, really? How so?
Well, think about it. Today, you have people setting up expensive ring lights to perfectly illuminate themselves crying in their cars, or carefully staging a corner of their bedroom to look quote-unquote messy so they appear relatable on video platforms like TikTok.
Oh, right. They're performing vulnerability.
Exactly. But Big Fatty wasn't performing. He was just genuinely hot, a little schvitzy, and didn't want to wear pants.
That is so true. The authenticity of 2008 digital media came from a genuine lack of curation.
Right. The nudity isn't there primarily for shock value, though it definitely achieves that.
For sure.
It completely strips away any remaining layers of pretense. When the host tells you they're sitting there naked and sweating, the listener is forced to visualize the biological reality of the creators.
Yeah, the medium of audio allows for this theater of the mind.
Yeah.
And he is just filling that theater with domestic chaos.
Okay, so if the Fat Cave is his controlled environment for domestic chaos, what happens when he steps out into public spaces?
Well, that's exactly where the timeline moves us next, right into August 27th and 28th.
And the focus shifts away from South Carolina and lands squarely in the middle of a family theme park in Orlando, Florida.
Yes, which brings us to a monumental event, the 150th broadcast milestone.
But the lead up to this is perfectly messy, of course.
Of course. So on August 27th, which he labels Hump Day, Brian has already departed early.
Right. He's heading up to a location Big Fatty explicitly refers to as Virginia's Vagina.
Yeah. And because Brian is gone, Big Fatty is thrown completely off his rhythm. He actually fumbles the opening of the show, admitting on tape, I'm getting into the habit of F up the openings, and I'm not real comfortable sitting here right now.
And he just leaves the mistake in the final cut.
Yeah, which again reinforces that anti-curation aesthetic we were talking about.
But that fumbled opening is merely the preamble to the actual 150th broadcast on Thursday, August 28th.
Right. Now, for any standard creator, a 150th milestone is a time for a polished retrospective.
You know, you play a montage of your best moments, you emotionally thank your loyal listeners, reflect on the growth of the community, all of that.
Naturally. Big Fatty, however, decides to celebrate 150 consecutive daily shows by introducing a segment called Big Fat Tales from Orlando.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. He promises to take the audience back to a time when network peers united in one city for one weekend.
And the story he chooses to immortalize is one of absolute boundary-pushing menace.
It really is. He recounts the Haunted Mansion incident.
Okay, you have to break this down.
So he details how two of his network peers, Fairy Princess Holly and Taffy, actively decided to ride the Haunted Mansion attraction at Disney, specifically to avoid him.
They were running away.
Yes. They were trying to escape being what he explicitly calls finger-banged by Big Fatty.
The contrast there is just so jarring. You have this wholesome, heavily sanitized corporate environment of a Disney park colliding with the hyper-explicit threat of his physical presence.
And he doesn't shy away from being the villain in this scenario at all.
No, he embraces it.
He openly admits that once they thought they were safe, he emerged from behind a bush, intercepted them, and forced them to ride the Haunted Mansion again.
Oh my gosh.
But he insisted they ride into the glory with a sexual spin. A whole lot of fat.
Wow, he is essentially holding them hostage in a doom buggy.
Literally holding them hostage on a Disney ride.
But you know, if we look closely at the mechanics of community building, this kind of hyper-explicit, localized lore functions as a massive cultural moat around the show.
A cultural moat. That makes perfect sense, actually.
Right.
Imagine a casual listener browsing iTunes. They see a show celebrating a milestone and decide to check it out.
And the very first thing they hear is the host gleefully recounting a story about jumping out from behind a bush to threaten his friends with inappropriate touching on a children's ride.
Yeah, they're either going to run away instantly or they're going to accept the absurdity and become a lifelong fan.
It's an aggressive filter. It ensures that only the truly dedicated remain inside the moat.
Exactly. He is actively repelling people who require a polished, safe listening experience.
It also strikes me that the audio journal itself is structured exactly like a dark ride.
Wait, like the Haunted Mansion itself?
Yeah. Think about it. You strap in, the environment is completely controlled, the lights go out, and things just jump out at you.
Oh, it's brilliant. Big Fatty uses the rigid 20-minute daily format as the doom buggy.
Exactly. He straps the listener in and then fills that rigid structure with jump scares of inappropriate behavior.
And he continues this chaotic celebration of the milestone with a demonstration of pure, unedited live performance.
Ah, yes, the live subscription.
So during the broadcast, he decides to open a package he received. He pre-opened the envelope, but hasn't looked inside.
And right in the middle of this grand unboxing, the phone rings.
It's Miss Kitty calling.
And instead of hitting pause or, you know, editing the audio later, he just answers it live on the air and folds her right into the milestone.
But then he transitions into this incredibly tedious real-time activity.
Right. He decides to spend his big milestone live, subscribing to his network peers on the iTunes store.
Which, as anyone who used it in 2008 knows, was a notoriously slow and clunky software experience.
Extremely slow. He decides to search for a feed hosted by British John called In My Country and another one by Princess Hannah.
And he repeatedly emphasizes the name of Princess Hannah's show, which is Without Smearing My Eyeliner.
Without Smearing My Eyeliner. And he literally narrates his every keystroke.
Every single one.
He types in the name, gets no search results, realizes there's an apostrophe, retypes it.
He reads the category, describes the pretty roses on the album artwork, and reads out the episode titles, like episode one, Popping My Cherry.
He literally forces the listener to wait in real time as the iTunes store loads, all while repeating that he is doing it without smearing his eyeliner.
It is the ultimate subversion of expectations. You tune in for a milestone event, and you get live tech support and a story about Florida theme park terrorism.
It's just a complete rejection of broadcasting norms.
Totally. But as we look at the end of the broadcast week, Friday, August 29th, we see a fascinating shift.
Yeah, the focus moves entirely away from naked recording and Disney antics and turns toward real-world logistics, theater directing, and the meticulous mapping of his global community.
We really have to talk about the Bugsy Blues.
Right, because Big Fatty is not just a digital creator. He is the director of a local theater production.
And the way he describes his role as a director is completely at odds with the man we just heard recording without pants.
It's day and night. He is a strict taskmaster.
Yeah, he talks about running scene change, blocking rehearsals, drilling the actors on exactly what pieces of the set they have to move at what specific intervals in the dark.
And he enforces a strict aesthetic, demanding that the actors maintain good military haircuts.
Good military haircuts. The man who gleefully thrives on audio distortion and refuses to turn off his fan is demanding military precision from his local theater cast.
But he also shows this benevolent, almost paternalistic side.
How so?
Well, he announces that because it is Labor Day weekend, he is giving the cast Sunday night off to, quote unquote, let their hair down, what little hair they have, and to recharge their batteries.
Because on Monday, they transition from the imaginary taped lines of the rehearsal hall to the actual physical stage.
Right. And he outlines the psychological difficulty of this transition for the actors having to remember to actually open and close real heavy wooden doors instead of miming them.
He is actively managing cast morale, technical execution, and complex stage logistics. He is a responsible, highly organized leader.
It's wild.
I really struggle to reconcile these two versions of him. I mean, how does a community, whether it's his theater cast or his digital audience, survive when its leader is simultaneously this incredibly strict, organized taskmaster demanding precise rehearsals and an agent of pure, unfiltered ruination who hides behind bushes?
It feels completely contradictory.
It really does.
But, and, you know, it feels contradictory on the surface, but the discipline actually sustains the ruination.
What do you mean by that?
Think about it. The rigid structure of the theater director, the need for blocking, for rules, for schedules, is the exact same instinct that drives him to produce an audio journal every single weekday for exactly 20 minutes.
Oh, I see.
The structure is the container. The ruination is the liquid he pours into it. He needs the rigid walls of the rehearsal hall or the daily format to safely contain the absolute anarchy of his personality.
That makes a ton of sense. Without the strict taskmaster, the agent of chaos would just burn out.
Exactly. The container and the liquid.
And we see this exact blend of strict logistics and digital chaos in how he manages the incoming travel of his network peers.
A network VIPs.
Yes, the VIPs are descending upon Charleston. He is coordinating the incoming travel logistics for a small army of personalities, flying in specifically to see his play, the Bugsy Blues.
He literally lists them off, tracking their movements. He's got Superb, he's got Ryan Starr Jones and Jason from The Way We See It.
He notes that they initially planned to arrive Saturday and leave Sunday, but actually expanded their trip to arrive Friday.
And then he details the arrival of the heavy hitters. The patron saint of the network, Tim Cormall, and his other half, Ron Perhoe.
He has their exact flight schedule mapped out on the air.
Seriously?
Yeah, they fly in on the morning of the 12th, get a rental car, and fly out on the morning of the 15th.
Wow. He is operating as the central hub, the gravitational center for this entire network.
They are all physically traveling across the country to sit in a theater and watch the results of his military precision blocking rehearsals.
And while he is managing this physical influx into Charleston, he is simultaneously obsessing over the exact geographical locations of his digital audience through the listener map.
Right. In the era before ubiquitous smartphone location tracking, these early Web 2.0 mapping tools were super novel.
Yeah, the listener map tracks his digital chaos alongside physical real-world geography. He uses the Friday show to do a deep dive into the specific shout-outs left by listeners on this map.
It's not just a list of names, either. It's an interactive geography of inside jokes.
Like Frank in Atlanta.
Yes. He shouts out Frank in Atlanta, highlighting a wildly inappropriate comment involving the term man sausage.
Man sausage.
Yeah, which he traces back to the 1980s Australian pop band Men at Work.
Oh, of course.
He actually assigns his audience homework, challenging them to use the term man sausage in casual conversation that Friday. And if anyone asks where they got it, to tell them Big Fatty sent them.
He is leveraging his digital reach to inject his specific brand of ruination into physical workplaces across the country.
It's brilliant in a terrifying way. And he continues scanning the map. He calls out Dale from Vancouver, British Columbia.
He debates whether Eric from Little Rock, Arkansas is the same Eric with all the tattoos.
Right, getting all tangled up in the spelling of Eric with a C versus a K.
And then he spots a listener named Kenner, which instantly derails his train of thought as he launches into a nostalgic tangent about the vintage children's toy company of the same name.
These geographic anchors, a pin in Vancouver, a tattoo in Little Rock, they forge a really powerful parasocial bond.
The map validates the digital reach of the show in physical terms.
Absolutely. But, you know, while he loves to assert authority as a director and a network hub, his fundamental refusal to ever relinquish control or admit defeat often leads to explosive collisions with objective reality.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Which brings us to the most legally necessary segment of our show. We are officially opening the vault for Ruined Ruination.
Oh, I love this segment. This is the space where we are formally dedicated to correcting the factual errors, the stubborn inaccuracies, and the historical injustices found deeply embedded within the source material.
Because for all his radical honesty about his body and his domestic life, Big Fatty possesses a massive blind spot when it comes to being factually corrected.
And we have a stacked docket today. We really have to start with the most egregious historical injustice in the archives.
The Ryan Starr Jones iTunes saga.
Yes, this is the prime example of the fat cave reality distortion field.
Okay, to understand the gravity of this, we have to look at the technical landscape of 2008.
Right.
A dedicated listener and network peer, Ryan Starr Jones, had publicly complained to Big Fatty that his downloads were broken.
Because in 2008, getting audio onto an iPod relied entirely on a brittle technology called RSS, or really simple syndication.
Yeah, it was an XML file that basically told iTunes when new audio existed.
When it failed, Ryan was frustrated and pointed the finger directly at Big Fatty's feed.
And Big Fatty did not take this well.
Not at all.
He aggressively blamed Ryan's computer on the air. And in a display of pure authoritarian ego, he demanded that Ryan perform random acts of kindness out in the real world as penance for daring to question the technical integrity of the Big Fatty online feed.
He put a listener on trial and sentenced him to community service.
He really did. But the objective truth emerged shortly after, and it proved that Big Fatty was completely objectively wrong.
What actually happened?
Well, Apple had released an emergency software update, iTunes version 7.1, which coincided with the launch of the iPhone 3G.
Right.
This update contained a global flaw that broke XML parsing. Apple essentially broke the digital syndication ecosystem worldwide.
So it was not Ryan's computer.
No.
And it was not Big Fatty's feed.
Exactly. It was a multi-billion dollar tech giant's failure.
Ryan Starr Jones was totally vindicated. He was the victim of a macroeconomic tech failure.
But here is the ultimate injustice, and the reason this is the crown jewel of this segment.
Okay, tell me.
Big Fatty never formally apologized to Ryan.
Are you serious?
Yes. He never got on the mic and said, "I was wrong. You were right. I am sorry." He just absorbed the fact that Apple messed up and moved on, leaving Ryan's unjust sentence of random acts of kindness hanging in the wind.
That is a stunning refusal to admit fault.
It really is.
And this stubbornness extends from complex global software bugs down to the most trivial pop culture details.
Like what?
Take the Pixar movie released that summer, Wally.
Oh, the critically acclaimed animated film about a little robot on a ruined Earth, spelled W-A-A-L-E.
Right. Well, Big Fatty stubbornly insisted on mispronouncing the title, making it rhyme with Sally.
Wally likes Sally.
Exactly. He plants his flag on that hill and just refuses to move.
Bad.
And he operates in the exact same state of denial regarding the reality TV landscape of 2008.
Oh, American Idol.
Yes, American Idol was the biggest show on television, featuring a massive finale between David Cook and David Archuleta. Big Fatty had made an unyielding prediction that David Archuleta was going to win.
And when millions of Americans voted, and objective reality proved him wrong, when David Cook definitively won the competition, Big Fatty simply refused to accept it.
Right. He basically rejected the democratic results of a reality singing competition just because it didn't align with his personal judgment.
But I think the most socially awkward manifestation of this refusal to admit error is the Will/Scott naming error.
Oh, this one is painful.
Big Fatty spent an entire weekend socializing in person with a listener named Will. And for the entire duration of that weekend, Big Fatty looked this man in the eye and called him Scott.
For the whole weekend?
Yes. And when Will later called into the voicemail line to politely correct the host on his actual legal name, Big Fatty absorbed the correction without an ounce of contrition.
None at all.
There was no embarrassed apology for calling a man by the wrong name for 72 hours. He just took the information and kept moving.
It really presents a massive paradox.
It does. Logic dictates that if a host attacks a listener unjustly and refuses to apologize or stubbornly denies basic facts like a person's name, the audience will get frustrated and leave.
Right. The broadcasting industry tells us that presenting a pristine, perfectly accountable image is the ultimate goal.
But the reality distortion field proves the exact opposite.
By refusing to apologize, by being just as stubborn and irrational as a family member sitting at the Thanksgiving table, he proves that he is not playing a character.
Yeah, to apologize in a highly polished way is to admit that you are managing a brand.
And his refusal to manage the brand is the adhesive that binds the community to him. It requires the audience to actively engage, to correct him, and to participate in the messy reality of the show.
That is such a fascinating point. You know, we spend so much of our own lives trying to curate our mistakes.
We really do.
We carefully draft our emails. We immediately apologize for minor missteps. We use filters on our photos. And we desperately try to hide our irrational realities from the public because we are terrified of being perceived as flawed.
Yeah, but the source material from late August 2008 leaves us with a provocative concept to mull over.
What if the ultimate shortcut to building a deeply loyal, fiercely dedicated community isn't about being perfectly right or perfectly curated?
What if the true path to connection is simply being consistently, unapologetically, and spectacularly ruined?
Take a look at your own life. Look at the stubborn arguments you refuse to lose, the messy domestic realities you try to hide.
Stop trying to polish the rough edges.
Yeah, see what happens when you let the wind tunnel roar and just admit that you are a little schwitzy. You might find that people love the chaos far more than they love the curation.
It is a true testament to the magnetic power of unapologetic imperfection.
Thank you so much for joining us on this exhaustive exploration of the Big Fatty online source material. I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
We have so much more history to uncover, so many more mistakes to catalog, and so much more chaos to synthesize. Be sure to tune in next weekend for the newest exploration of the archives on Ruination, the early years. We will see you then.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, the early years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.